Welcome to IT Origins from Gestalt IT. This is where we talk to IT professionals, executives, and just cool people in IT and find out how they got started in this unique industry and where they're going from here. I don't really have much of a preamble for that. My name is Rich Strofolino. I'm your intrepid interviewer. My interviewee for this IT Origin is none other than Jack Daniel. Now, I'm told he's a titleless man, but I'm going to go with security professional. Sure, why not? Jack, sure. Thank you so much for being on IT Origins.
Hey, great to be with you. Thanks for asking me on.
Absolutely. So let's just jump right into it. Can you outline kind of your IT origin story? I always ask if it involves a radioactive spider. Basically, how long have you been in the field and how did you get your start?
Well, it's interesting. It's hard to put a specific date on when I got into the field. The short version of my origin story is long, and the long version requires cocktails at a bar for a long time. But the short version we'll go with here. Many decades ago, I was a mechanic. Specialized in some of the more difficult cars to fix and the biggest problems with them. And I was working on early computerized systems in Renault and Saab and some other esoteric vehicles. And because of that, I had to look up my own parts because I found weird stuff. And a lot of the French cars don't even have words in the catalog or in the microfilms, microfiche. So I had to look up my own parts. We had a crisis in the parts department. I had to go in and figure out how to get parts because we didn't have the right people anymore. And I went in and had to build my own parts because we were going to buy back cars. If I couldn't fix them, they said I had to stay in parts. For those that might be familiar with car business, the first, like a lot of industries, the first department that got computerized was accounting. And then the second one that tended to be computerized was the parts end because of inventory control, inventory management. So I walked in and had to learn a little bit about the computer systems. They said I had to stay in parts for a few weeks until they figured out how to fix it. And that turned into many years running parts operations for a dealer chain. But I had to learn the computer system. And then one day, not even a few weeks in, the owner of the company who ran the accounting end of it said, here, you have to put this tape thing in the computer thing and do these instructions or the parts are going to be the wrong prices. And then everything's screwed up. So that day at lunch, I went in and jammed this big cartridge tape into a mini computer and followed the instructions, and it was easy and the parts prices were right and a big pile of paper came out of a pin feed printer. And that was my introduction to actually doing anything other than being a user of a computer system. And just a few months later, she came to me with a shoebox full of these giant old cartridges, the big aluminum plate things on the base of them. Some folks are probably cringing thinking about the old data cartridges. But she handed me a shoebox of them and basically a small town phone book set of instructions and said, well, as long as you're doing the other tapes, you should do these. And I read it and it's like, oh, this is going to take all day. I have to come in on Sunday and do this. Not knowing any better, I said yes. Well, mostly because I wanted the paychecks to continue to come in. I said yes. And that weekend was when I learned things about like the importance of backups and what an operating system was and the joys of hold times and first level technical support and all sorts of other things. But on Monday morning, we had our computers up and running. And when the owner heard what a disaster it was, she was like, great, I hate doing those. You can do them from now on. So we fast forward decades, and I was doing more and more computer and telecommunications stuff in the dealer group and for some of their other businesses until we reached a point where I was trying to supervise all parts and service operations for a 7-franchise, 4 facility dealer group, plus run all the computer gear. And they said, you know what, we're spending too much on consultants. You become the computer guy. So I became computer guy. And in those days, Windows 95, 98 days, NT days, bad things happened to computers all the time because they were notoriously secure, right? So bad things happened. I had to fix it. A bad thing happened again. And it's like, I actually have to figure out how to secure these things and how people keep breaking them and how to do it with no money. And so I became the computer guy and got more and more interested in security. And, more of that story is that I had very little in the way of resources. I did go through a NT boot camps where not boot camp, an NT MCSE mill at the of the day, got all those lovely little certs on NT4 and then 2000. But where I learned most of the stuff that was practical day to day was I found a couple of user groups in the Boston area. Forget it what it was at the time, but it's now an IT pro group. But one in Providence was amazing. Great group of folks who were all underfunded and clever and scrappy network and systems admins, you know, NetWare and NT admins. And we kind of complained about everything and figured out how to fix stuff as a group and shared what we had learned. I started doing that and same thing in the Boston area, and I realized that the user group communities, the tech communities, were incredibly valuable. And after I learned things, I started sharing what I had learned. So fast forward another, you know, decade or so, and I'm mostly focused on security, network security, system security for still getting a paycheck from one dealer, but doing it for a lot of car dealers. See the handwriting on the wall for the auto industry. This is about 10, 12 years ago. Jumped into vendor space with a firewall company called Astaro, later acquired by Sophos. Spent some years there. It was a great time. And then six and a half years ago, I joined Tenable, the Nessus folks, and have been there ever since. And, you know, along the way, other things happened, like some years ago in 2009, a group of friends and I got together and made a thing happen in Vegas called Security B-Sides. And that sort of took off. We thought we were doing one event. And I just got word that there's going to be one in Istanbul, Turkey, later this year, early next year. You know, Cairo, Egypt is on the map. Harare, Zimbabwe is on the map now for things coming up. So that Security B-Sides has been a big part of the past almost 10 years for me since 2009 work. And, you know, a lot of community building stuff. But I am basically a displaced auto mechanic. They said I could go back to the tools as soon as they got parts under control. And many decades later, I guess I don't get to go back on the tools.
That's pretty remarkable. Like what around what year were you first introduced? I mean, you said mini computers, so that kind of gives me an indication. But like around when did that first shift?
Let's see. That would have been 87, 86, 87 when I was. Probably 87, I think, was when I made the transition into the parts department and started playing with things. But it's been fuzzy ever since because, you know, like I said, there were days that I would get up at 2 or 3 in the morning, drive to the dealership, plow snow for one of the dealerships, roll out of the snow plow, work in the parts department. And then run upstairs, do some accounting, internal audit stuff, because I did that as a hobby to catch the criminals, because the stereotypes of crooks and car dealers come from reality. and then somewhere around 10 or 11 o'clock at night, I'd change and then go rebuild an automatic transmission. About 2 in the morning, I'd go to sleep, unless it was still snowing, in which case I'd just get back in the plow truck. So it was, you know, there were days when I would spend, you know, a week or two doing new installations at a new facility or something like that, and doing nothing but computers. You know, bad things would happen to NT, you know, IIS4 running on NT4 or, you know, Exchange 5 and 5.5, and that would be my world for a while. So it was very transitional until, the late 90s, it became full-time technology, and shortly thereafter, security became a focus. So it's it was very gradual. It's why it's hard to say it's, you know, put a pin in something.
So in those 2 decades, really, since, you know, kind of security became your main focus, what's been the biggest change that you've seen in that time, and specifically in security, I'm wondering? Like, what is
nothing. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. That is a very flip answer, but also amazingly accurate. A lot of things have changed. The complexity, the diversity of devices, the speed, connectivity, connectivity and speed of connectivity is dramatically different. The number of devices interconnected is insanely different. The number of different types of devices facing, and the number of different types of systems. You know, what we call a host is, do you mean a container? You know, do we count as an asset? Do we count a service running on a server? Do we count one of the services in a container? Is it something in a VM? Is it a piece of hardware? Is it a laptop? Is it your iPhone? Is it my Apple Watch? You know, the complexity has grown dramatically. And the connectivity is insane. Although the thing about connectivity, as any of your listeners who are road warriors know, is that the connectivity is great until you actually rely on it when you know, you're out on the road, because the promise of ubiquitous global high speed internet is a lie. But you know, we have a lot of connectivity, and it gets more and more complex. And everything that seems to be more simplifying, you know, containers simplify a lot of things at some levels until you have to diagnose them. You know, they add a layers of security because it keeps, you know, properly deployed with no, you know, for example, good thing there aren't any fundamental silicon level flaws in chipsets, or it would like throw out everything we've done for security in some ways. Yeah. Oh, right.
Luckily,
fundamental flaws. And we can easily fix these. And depending on what you're doing, it may have little or no impact on performance, or you might be buying a lot more cores very fast. But, you know, complexity and interconnection is accelerating. And we have, every time we move forward in some levels, there are challenges. So there are things like iOS, you know, the Apple iOS devices are locked down pretty well. They're not perfect, but they've done an amazing number of things. But we lose what drew a lot of us into computing, the flexibility and the power of that flexibility, which also allows us to do dumb stuff and become, you know, compromised. Windows has moved more and more to an Apple model, but they still have, you know, they've made enormous strides, but there are still some real fundamental problems. The shortage of people is an interesting thing. Over the years, there have been things that I think are a challenge that we've seen a lot of. If you go back to the beginnings of technology, of computers and security, the computer systems themselves were rare and incredibly expensive. But the people were considered to be largely just above clerical in some cases, or technical. But the people were available and not extremely well paid. And the systems were scarce and extremely expensive. And now competent people are competent and experienced people are hard to find in many areas. And the computers are just effectively free when you look at the cost of them, and that has it's an interesting shift that the computers were cheap, and you know, computers are cheap and people are expensive as opposed to what it used to be. And there are all sorts of things that go along with that that are a challenge. You know, one of the fundamentals of that is, you know, I need a system to do this one thing. I need it to turn the lights off and on and tell me if the temperature goes out of range. Well, you know, QNX or some other stripped down OS on a custom chipset is the way to do that, because nothing's going to go wrong. But that will cost way too much money, so we'll put a Raspberry Pi running a full OS with a complete set of vulnerabilities brought in from libraries that are ancient and nobody's really looked at the code ever, you know, and but that's the cheapest way to do it. And that sort of, let's run a full computer to turn the lights off and on model. It makes, you know, financial sense, but it does also lead to the state of IoT security, the state of connected things. So it's interesting. That's not a simple answer, but you know what? I'll go back to nothing has changed.
Well, you know, how about in terms of security, the state of the idea of security as a community in terms of, you know, having, I mean, I realize, you know, before the internet, there were all sorts of, you know, you could post on Gopher or your BBS or whatnot. Has the effect of having a wider community of security minded professionals had any effect on security, computer security as a whole?
Yeah, it has. However, I think it needs to be made clear that I never use the word community when talking about the security community, always plural communities. And I actually think that there's a model that makes more sense than talking about communities, and it gets twisted. But if we think of, you know, anthropological terms, we think of, you know, nations, tribes, clans, and families, except we have the interesting mix of within these greater subsets. And perhaps we'll call the hackers the nation and the tribe of hardware hackers versus software hackers versus, the more, web app, whatever, particular bent your hacking takes you, you know, brings you down into tribes and clans and families. And then on the InfoSec side, you have, you know, the tribe of people who secure industry versus those of us perhaps in vendor space. But unlike that model for grouping people anthropologically, we have a huge overlap. So there are people that, you know, there's the RSA tribe and the Black Hat tribe and the DEFCON tribe, for example, and there's overlap in between them. So it's really complex. But the thing to remember is that it's not universal. If you address issues of like what the word hacker means, there are a lot of us who understand that that's a neutral term and could mean people that do good things, and it could mean people who do bad things, and it could mean people that straddle the line sometimes. But with other huge swaths of the industry of you know, InfoSec, there are a lot of people who think that hackers are all criminals, just like mainstream media has portrayed that term. When you say InfoSec, some people have an idea. If you say network security, some people have an idea. So it's and that is one of our challenges. We've got a lot of silos and a lot of stratification. It is better in some ways because the resources are available, but trying to figure out who to talk to that has some experience in an area is a lot easier if you can find where that community or tribe or clan hangs out. If you're looking for technical and tactical, you're probably better off looking in Twitter, as much as that's no fun. If you're looking for, you know, management, or if you're looking for, you know, mid-tier management, then you hold your nose and dive into LinkedIn. That was a little editorializing, wasn't it, Jack? You know, and if you're trying to get to the executives, they're executives. They'll find you if they want you. Otherwise, leave them alone. They have real jobs and stuff. It has helped in some ways. If you're in one of those communities that communicates well, there are some great projects. There's the leet list that some folks are working on that's based on, you know, Twitter. But that means that it's really tying a lot of more technical and tactical folks together, people who self-identify as hackers. So if you're in one of those groups that has great communications, it's great. But if I'm, you know, identifying as part of the DEF CON crowd, I don't have an easy path to folks in academia unless I've been around for a while and made those connections. So it's a really long-winded answer.
Oh, no, not a problem. I mean, it was a very structuralist, if I'm going to go anthropological, approach to the question. So that's really interesting. Do you think that has something to do that it seems, at least from an outsider's perspective, that overall, you know, security has resisted, you know, whether it be InfoSec or hackers or you know, whatnot, has resisted all-out professionalization. You know, it's not like you can get there's no like CCIE of being a hacker, for lack of a better term.
There's a challenge there that so part of the battle with information security, cybersecurity, whatever term we want to use, you know, in the hacker world as well, is that the technology is changing at a pace that effectively prevents thorough standardization. We don't have, how to put this carefully, medical science, the arts and sciences of medicine are evolving rapidly. They're changing dramatically. People are understanding more and more interrelationships between a whole bunch of things. So it is a highly dynamic world, and it is literally life or death. But it starts and can build on millennia of understanding of the human body, of animal bodies, of biology and other things. And, you know, the last couple centuries is where we really have to focus, because before that, you know, it's a little sketchy. And even in the past 30 or 40 years, you know, a lot of people are looking forward to the day when we look back on chemotherapy the way we look back on, you know, random bloodletting or leeches or, you know, burning at the stake to purify. Yeah, exactly. But there are things to build on that go a long way. And, it's come a long way, but if you know how to, you know, it's like, that's a simple fracture. We know how to set this. How do you solve a network connectivity issue that's exposed something that shouldn't be exposed on Windows 10 oh, wait, which level of Windows 10? Is it 64 or 32? You know, as opposed to NT4. And it's one of the challenges is that if you're responsible for securing an environment, you have to do the stuff which amounts to putting a lot of bandages on things. We patch things. We update things. We do mitigations and workarounds to protect those things. And it has to be done today because otherwise we're going to be we're likely to suffer. We have to prioritize it and think about risk in a logical way, but we still have to secure the systems that are exposed to attack. But for every patch that you apply in your environment, it is largely distracting you from building a robust and secure infrastructure, unless you have the resources to do both, and very few people have that luxury. And the more effort that gets put into patching software, the less effort that goes into, in general, huge sweeping, you know, paint with a broad brush terms here, the more effort we put into figuring out how to fix technical debt one problem at a time rather than building, you know, more fundamentally secure systems, we're wasting a ton of time. Meanwhile, in academia and other places, people are working on those big problems. And they end up with results like the Orange Book decades ago, which was a brilliant idea, except it completely discounted usability and the user's desire to, I just want to do my job, stop it. And thus completely subverting, in many ways, the value of the Orange Book. It really, the stuff that you have to learn for, you know, some of the certs like CISSP and other things, Bell La Padula and stuff. You know, some of those folks that worked on the Rainbow series now look back at it and it's like, oh, yeah, we should have probably paid some attention to what, you know, the fundamental truth is that most people who use computers are just trying to get something done. You know, they don't use the computer to be secure. And if we get too much in their way, we make it difficult. So
it's we have some fundamental convenience versus security spectrum, right?
Right. And, it, you know, that shouldn't be it. We should I like to think of it as if we can make it easy to do the right thing or harder to do the wrong thing. That's the way to look at it, because we can't solve these problems. But if we make it easier to do the right thing or harder to do the wrong thing, we're headed in the right direction. And, you know, that gets into one of my pet peeves, which is there's a lot of absolutism, especially from the technical side of information security. And sometimes it's a lack of perspective, but there's, you know, folks that have heard me talk about these things before are sick of hearing it, but I will say it, you know, again, for you and your audience, if you have not had, you know, my, I don't know what to call this, one of my pivotal moments in understanding risk was we needed to renew support and maintenance for our set of firewalls and web filtering systems many years ago. And I went to the owner of the company and said, hey, I need this much money to renew these services. And otherwise things stop flowing, or, you know, we have to just open it up and we lose all the security. And she looked at me and said, you can't have the money. I'm like, but we need it. She says, well, if you have that money, we don't make payroll, because that's how close we are this month. We're actually borrowing some money from a couple other accounts so that we can make payroll this week. And because at the time I was doing some of the, like I said, some audit of some of the more interesting managers we had, I had access to the numbers. I went in and looked, and I'm like, okay. And I grabbed some old workstations, cobbled together some open source firewalls to put a little security in place, and didn't, because I was given the choice of do security right, air quotes, or make payroll. And if you're in business, one of these is a risk at a small level, and one of these is the doors don't open in 2 or 3 weeks.
It's existential at that point.
Right, right. And so I don't advise people to go out in search of jobs that are so horrible where you have to where you find yourself in that situation. But it does teach you some really visceral lessons, like, oh, not only do I not get a paycheck, none of my friends and coworkers get paychecks, and some of them can't skip a week or they're, you know, paycheck to paycheck, they're screwed. Oh, well, you know, I guess we're going to have to just not be as secure for the next 3 or 4 months until we can dig out of the hole. And a lot of folks have their own stories like that of understanding that. There's, you know, there are things like we need to improve password complexity. Well, that'll take 4 years. Why does it take 4 years? Well, we're on a 3-year contract cycle, and it'll take a year to negotiate the contract, and that has to be worked into the, you know, because it'll change the amount of time it takes for employees to do their job. And, you know, it's a union shop. If you've never run into that, the just use Staranger passwords argument might seem simple. You know, there are a lot of those sort of things where we if we don't have the perspective and actually listen to other people that have been in horrible situations, we think it's easy. And so the absolutism kind of drives me nuts.
Would you say that kind of absolutism is one of the worst trends in IT, to lean into one of our other questions?
Yeah, but I can't just blame it on IT. IT does not work in a bubble. Society at large has been driven to extremes. Not to get into politics, but there are very few issues where people don't just push to one extreme or another and take absolutist positions, and we're not immune to it. I think that linking them over, you know, too much is a leap, but there really is an issue of not having a lot of empathy for people in other positions. You know, every time there's a patch, the argument of just patch versus it's not that simple comes up, and you can see it usually on Twitter. Some places are a lot more absolutist or take one side more than another, but you can see these battles over why don't they just patch? And, you know, it's like it's not just patch. It's much more complex than that. It's like, well, just add a you know, WAF rule, you know, to tweak your web app firewall to protect against that. It's like, do you have any idea how complex these web apps are we're running? This is not like, you know, those that have been around for a while and doing web stuff, where even if you had a dynamic website, there were parts of your website that were pretty static, and it was not uncommon for folks to figure out, oh, this never has to change, even though it's kind of a kludge. I'm going to run it off of a CD. Go ahead and pop that. You know, I remember Marcus Ranum running sites that basically rebooted continuously. You know, they restarted the service continuously. So if you managed to dig a hole in a matter of seconds, the hole was filled in when the system restarted, because it was a series of fixed links. I defy you to try that with any modern website. You're never going to get all the way to the database to pull up the picture of the toaster oven to sell on Amazon or whatever it is you're trying to provide as a service. Or, you know, your awful autoplay music and video at the news sites. I know those. I'm okay if those fail.
Yeah. But, that's a privacy badger for it. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but yeah.
It the guy on Twitter that, you know, at replies with all you have to do is the worst might be the worst trend.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. And so I'm kind of on the other end, though. What is one of the best trends in IT or in security overall that you've seen recently?
There are a couple of things that give me hope. There were a lot of folks starting to understand the value of connection and community. There are a lot of people that share what they know. It used to be a little harder to find those people. So one of the real advantages of connectivity is that it's a lot easier to find people who have a skill set. Now, if you're looking for a couple of, you know, a quick answer or somebody to point you in the right direction, that's a lot easier. The downside of that one is that if you're looking for somebody to give you career advice and you look on Twitter or LinkedIn or something, the people that answer are often the ones that aren't too busy. And those of us that are easy to approach are often buried. I won't name anybody else because they're already all too buried. But there are a lot of people. And if you're a little patient, if you're patient and polite, it's amazing what resources you can find to help you move through your career. You know, whether you're just trying to get past one problem, it's I'm trying to debug this and I'm stuck here, or I'm trying to break into the system and I'm almost there, but you know, this Metasploit module doesn't work. If you dig around and you're patient and polite, you will find that there are an amazing number of people willing to help you, and that is based on, and for that to continue to grow, by the way, to be idealistic, that means that once you've had that experience, you answer the next person who asks you something, because that's how we build. And that's very positive. I think there's some fundamental understandings of security that are getting better. Like I mentioned, I have a love hate. Apple products annoy me immensely. Windows products annoy me. I find, you know, the platform that annoys me least for the job. I'm not a purist by any means, but some of these stripped down. So iOS, I think, headed us in a direction. We gave up all sorts of flexibility and power. Moving from Android to iOS is like, you know, throwing training wheels on your Ferrari and, you know, taking most of the engine out. But on the other hand, it starts when you want it and things like that. It's not what it used to be. But there's a lot less attack surface, and the surface that's there keeps getting tightened down and down and down. Android is getting there. They got it out and it was a disaster. The ecosystem is imperfect, but Android, the core system, is a lot tighter now. You know, the core systems, the core OSs are dramatically more secure than they used to be. So there are things. We're learning how to do things better. So there is reason to be optimistic, but there is no reason to worry about us solving all the problems and not needing any of us in the industry anymore anytime soon.
So kind of shifting away from purely IT, just kind of delving into a little bit more of some productivity and kind of organizational tips. I always like to find out how people approach organization at their jobs or at their work or whatnot. Do you have any kind of must-use apps, any like specific systems to organization? Are you like a weird bullet journaler? And if you do bullet journal, I apologize. It's not weird. I just can never wrap my head around it. How do you like to organize your workspace? I'm always curious about process.
There are many topics people can ask me for advice on. This is not one that anyone should take my advice on. completely random, chaos theory describes my desk, my brain, my computers. I will say that something that everybody needs to be aware of, one of the topics I've spoken on is coping with stress and burnout. Keep coping with stress in general, not just work related, but life related stress. Stress is destructive to memory. I've had some things happen in my life in the past few decades, which were highly stressful. I have an amazing, wonderful job, which is not stressful. And as a result, and also I'm not young anymore. I am 58 as of a few weeks ago, and my memory is a disaster. So pen and paper is the crucial component of my, even though I, you know, live like a lot of us live by spreadsheets and a lot of other organizational apps, spreadsheets, and calendars, layers and layers and layers of calendars. But I am absolutely pen and paper, and half the time I never look at it again, but you know, it's been proven over and over and over again that if you pick up pen or pencil and scribble something on a piece of paper, it has a dramatically higher impact on retention than any other method. Typing into a computer is better than just trying to remember it, but it's nowhere near as powerful as pen and paper. And since my memory has taken the beating it has, I live with a notebook with me at all times. Actually, two of them. One for my stand-up comedy, which I do as a relief from life. But the other one is pretty much everything but stand-up comedy. It goes in there: work and security B-side stuff, and personal stuff, and things I forgot to do. I have a note here that says turn on the dryer after this interview is over so that I didn't start it before. You know, we don't need to hear that clunking in the background. Even with this mic, you might pick up a little bit. So, that's where I am, pen and paper. But as far as tools, I was a Lotus, spreadsheet user long ago and finally gave up and went to Excel years ago. And that's the tool. But yeah, if you want to be neat and organized and Kanban and bullet, yeah, ask somebody who's actually organized. Ask somebody that, I don't know, I won't mention what's scattered across my desk right now, but people would be horrified to see what's on my desk right now. And it works for me. Post-it notes, I have cases of post-it notes that I've gathered from, you know, years of going to conferences. Those are wonderful whiteboards. But to me, the fundamental is scribble it down somewhere.
Just get in that muscle memory, and then it'll work its way.
And again, I'm not writing code. I am no longer a product manager. So I'm doing a lot of scattered things. I get away with stuff that people with real jobs couldn't.
And so any preference on a notebook? Is it just the Mead that's on, or the 49 cent composition notebook? Or are you, do you have a little bit preference on that?
I use something I pick up at one of the office stores. What is the size? I don't know. I use a top spiral thing that's like a 5x8 or something. So it's not a full-sized 8.5x11. Those are a little too clunky. It's not a little tiny one because you can't put tons of stuff in. And I like the top spiral just because it's not in the way as you scribble extended notes. But it's whatever form factor works for you. This I've settled on one at one of the giant chains always has, and I usually have two going. I have the one that I haven't transcribed all the notes from left, that's got three tattered pages left, and then the working one. And that's what I work on. And if I ever lose those, I've lost one a few years ago, and it was I was apoplectic, so I now am better about it.
All right, so any book recommendations for any aspiring security professionals out there, or perhaps not books, places for to find kind of the community help and dig deep in there that you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, so there are all sorts of them. There's a book that read or listen to the audiobook if you're into audiobooks, which I am, which I like to tell people is one of the greatest hacking books ever done. It's a wonderful information security, social engineering hacking book, and it is actually about none of the above. I'm a huge fan of Terry Pratchett. Terry Pratchett's Going Postal is an amazing book. I'm not going to give away much for folks that haven't read it, but it is one of the best hacker books ever written, and it's not a hacker book.
I love it. I love it. Let's get some go back real far in the IT origin. First computer you ever owned.
So the first one that I owned, so I was using them at work a lot, but as personal, I got one that we dumped at work and ended up as my first one at the house. So I was using them for many, many years. But the first one that went into the house was one of the worst computers ever made. It was the Apple III Plus.
I was joking in my mind, like in my head, I was like, oh, what is it? Now, like the chips popping off and everything?
Apple III Plus. They had a... I had about a 400% motherboard failure rate, if I remember the stats. It was usually your fourth to sixth motherboard before it was a stable device. The hard drive was bigger than most compact desktop computers now. It had floppies. It was just a tank of a thing. Performance was hideous. It was their first attempt at a business computer. The three was their first attempt at a business computer. It was an abject failure. The 3 Plus was more usable as a business computer, but it had hardware failures that were just catastrophic and epic. But I did that for a while, and I would put numbers into it and do a little word processing. And then after that, I forget where it went. But, that was after, amazingly enough, when you're dealing with Unix variant mini computers all day long. I was never really into gaming and really just didn't want to face a computer when I got home, especially the old green screen CRTs where your retinas were burned anyway by the time you got home. 10-12 hours a day of staring at WISE terminals or other things, I really didn't want to. So when I did, I did. And now, of course, I say that, and I tell people, I'm really not technical anymore, and I'm looking at two laptops, one with an external monitor, another with two external monitors, and a handful of servers and various form factors across the room, and that's downsized for me. But I'm staring at five computer screens right now at my desk, not counting the phones and my Apple Watch, because those aren't really computers, even though they have radios and quad-core processors with...
They're computer-like. They're computer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the phones. It's if you have a phone that's been made in the past several years that's anywhere near the top of the food chain, it's got a quad-core 64-bit processor. The bus speed for memory is faster than supercomputers were not that long ago. If it's something that has removable storage, the micro SD card reads and writes faster than hard drives you could buy not that long ago, and you can put more data in something the smaller than your thumbnail. The power of them is stunning. Unfortunately, just to throw rocks at developers, which I hate to do because I feel guilty because I'm not one, none of them have remembered how to optimize code. And so it takes all of that power just to get OkCupid to open. To get something business related to open. Let's not go to OkCupid.
Tinder. Oh, no, wait.
Yeah. Yes. Well, yes, there's a whole set of conversations we won't go into there about privacy and security and people having one objective and really not caring about privacy and security, when they really should. And I think that's probably a great symptom, maybe not for this podcast, but it's a great one to look into when people are focused on one thing and not thinking about the consequences. Little micro study in information security and privacy, those dating apps are.
Yeah, I always wonder, you know, where is the anthropologies going back to that? That was my undergrad, so it kind of always is in my mind of you know, InfoSec, of enterprise IT. Like, I always think these communities or tribes or what have you have these interesting subcultures and practices and stuff like that. And I always feel like there's not, you know, we pay attention to the results of that, but not how kind of the sausage gets made. And I always think that would be fascinating.
Yeah, actually, if you're into social engineering and stuff, whether or not you're dating, I won't say which sites, but there are dating sites that have a real issue with both scammers and professional escorts. And they are ridiculously easy to spot. And it's one of those where you try to figure it out. I've actually tried to engage people I've spotted as being illegitimate, you know, and trying to figure out if it's a scam or if it's, you know, a professional escort that's been driven to those sites because of the nature of American society or what. But none of them want to engage in a conversation. So apparently the way to approach them is not so clearly. This is BS, but I'd love to chat with you about your special brand of BS. It doesn't make friends on dating sites. I don't know. So, we all have interesting hobbies. That's messing with criminals on dating sites. Just as one of my recent ones.
let's all be alone together. All right. So, Jack, what do you do when you're not working in security?
There's a real kind of blur because of the nature of my job. I'm being engaged with the community, helping the B-Sides community, helping specific B-Sides events and B-Sides in general is a huge part of what I do for my employer. And so that's what I do when I'm not working, but it's sort of working. I do a lot of public speaking on topics like the past, present, future of information security, my Shoulders of InfoSec project, which the wiki needs a big update, but is a history of information security. And I'm starting to get into the hacker space and some other things. And it's just a wiki of names of people and some of their stories and links to some of the stories, the people that founded the industry that we're in. And so I do talks on that. I do talks on how to give better presentations and on stress and burnout and coping and survival skills when I'm not talking about things directly related to the nice folks who send me paychecks regularly. So I do a lot of that. But as far as for fun, I am an amateur bartender. I have been dragged into bartending contests with professionals because I take it seriously. I have a lot of hobbies I don't have time for. I'm ornamental ironwork blacksmith. I'm trying to get my forge set up at my new place. I've moved south to get away from winter. Didn't move far enough south this year. trying to get back into wood carving. I read some interesting things. I just wander aimlessly through life. My life has been in dramatic upheaval for the past couple of years. And so I'm just wandering aimlessly through life. So it depends. I travel a lot for work, and I often have the luxury of being able to extend that travel for personal reasons, burn some vacation time. So I travel, I hang out with friends, I go to a lot of conferences, which is both work and pleasure. And wander aimlessly through life, but very purposely wandering very aimlessly through life.
All right. And the always important question for anyone, it seems like, that's looking at a computer screen all day, how do you caffeine?
I started years ago when I started working from home. I started doing what a lot of people who work from home do, which is roll out of bed and then sit in front of a computer. And then like 12 or 14 hours later, realize life has passed you by again. So I started getting up and going out to the coffee shops just to start the day. So I had a commute, and I still do that most days when I'm home, although I was away from home 215 days last year. So most, you know, that was, I wanted to, new life, but, so I tend to do, lattes with, I do caramel lattes with enough extra shots so that they're not milky sweet things, that they're actually, basically the goal is to cover, three of the four basic food groups, fat, sugar, and caffeine. If I need a balanced diet, I will have a mocha because that adds chocolate, the fourth of the four major food groups. But generally I do, caramel lattes with enough extra shots that it no longer tastes like, a watery, sugary mush, like, you know, Starbucks or somebody wants to sell you.
All right. And as, since you mentioned you are an amateur bartender, I always like to ask this of bartender folk, what is the drink that if I came in and ordered, you would think, hey, this guy knows what's going on. He's cool.
Depends on where you are. For most bars, I have a progression for traditional bars, which starts with an old fashioned. And then the next step up is a Sazerac, which is not that much more complicated, but it's like the Sazerac is an old school classic. It's a New Orleans classic made well. They're beautiful. And it really is something that draws a line it draws a line for the bar and the bartender, the Sazerac. And if you want to take it further, I'll go to an even older and more esoteric New Orleans classic, the Vieux-Carré. But the Sazerac is the magic line in the sand. Unless you're at a tiki bar, a proper tiki style bar, which have been in revival for a few years, and in which case the painkiller is fairly simple, but you have to get the balance of rums right, and you have to have the right juices, and they've got to be fresh to pull it off. And it's not terribly difficult to do a really good painkiller, but you have to have fresh ingredients, and you have to know what you're doing and do it well. So those are the two. But in general, the Sazerac is the go-to. And if you really want to test people, ask them for a daiquiri, and nobody does daiquiris well. They're a proper daiquiri is one of those things that's extremely simple. It has three ingredients, and if you get any of it even slightly wrong, they're horrible. So there's actually three of them. But, you know, daiquiris do not come out of a Slurpee machine, you know, let's put it that way. But, you know, it's not like going, you know, the 28 flavors of daiquiri that you can find on Bourbon Street in New Orleans, none of them are daiquiri. But those are three. So it depends on the bar. But generally speaking, classic bars, the Sazerac is a line in the sand. And if you venture over that and do well, you can probably tell the bartender and the bar actually have some skill. And, you know, there are places for bars that open aluminum bottles of beer and serve, you know, alcohol out of the well, mixed one and one with soft drinks. there are places for them. And it's not near me.
So where does a Harvey Wallbanger fall on the cool, not cool spectrum?
For me, it's not very cool, but I'm also not judgmental. I mean, if you go into someplace like Lost Lake in Chicago and ask for Harvey Wallbanger, you're in the wrong place. It's one of the premier tiki bars in the U.S. If you go into Cannon in Seattle and ask for one, you're in the wrong place. But if you go into, you know, your local bar that has a good environment, that's fine. And if you enjoy it, that's great. It's like if I go down to my local watering hole here and people are drinking, you know, Yingling or Bud Light, that's fine. I'm not drinking those things. you know, let's not get crazy. And, you know, and also if you go in there because you like the music and, you know, you're drinking club soda and lime and not having alcohol, that's cool too. You know, that's one of the things that is also a real test of bars. And this is absolute master level for a lot of folks is bars that make people who aren't drinking feel comfortable and welcome. And sometimes it's because you don't drink because you're on something medicine for a week that you shouldn't drink. Sometimes it's because you no longer drink for a whole variety of reasons. Sometimes it's because you're the one who's driving and shouldn't be. So there's another really important test for bars is they're like, oh, hey, well, I've got a lot of fruit juices here. I could do something interesting, or you want to just do like ginger ale and bitters. Those folks that get that, actually care about their patrons and the craft. You can tell I think about bartending way too much.
Now I do want a ginger ale and bitters. That does sound very refreshing. All right, we'll get you on the last two questions here. Who would you like to see answer these questions?
There are all sorts of people that come to mind who are the usual suspects of amazing people, and there are too many to list, whether it's Leslie Carhart or Wendy Nather or others. But I will give you a category of people.
Oh, I like this.
Which is going to be a little harder. And later we can I'll throw a couple to you privately. I would say ask these questions of people who are too new to be able to answer them well, to get the outsider's perspective, those who have just stepped into this industry. They're people that are transitioning into our industry, and they have fresh views on the world. They tend to be younger, and when you ask them things about trends, their view of trends is going to be on a lot shorter timeline. It's not going to be from some cranky old guy who got into this and then looked back decades. And, you know, I tell people, look at the Ware report, which was drafted originally in 67. And I give that advice still, and I still think that's valid advice. But grabbing some of the younger people and some of the transitional people. But like I said, you know, there are so many. But whenever I get put on the spot, I go to Leslie Carhart and Wendy Nather because they're amazing. But there's so many great folks in our industry. But I would say, you know, go to the people that actually don't have the depth of experience to really answer these questions. Put them on the spot. And I bet we'll all learn from that.
That is a really, really thoughtful answer. I really appreciate that. And so let's get out on this. Best career advice you've ever received.
So it's not specifically career advice, but it, an insight into career many, many years ago when I was before I, developed a male pattern baldness and had long flowing ponytail and, a much shorter beard. I was a mechanic and specialized in Renault, cars and was performance tuning them and other amazing things. And the place I worked was acquired by a Cadillac dealer, and I was parking a car, and an elderly woman was getting into her new Cadillac, and I don't even remember what the problem was, but she was struggling with something. So I kind of like, oh, she's terrified of the little hippie kid, but I'm going to go over and try to help her. And so I gently went up to her and chatted with her briefly and explained how something worked, the new change in the early 80s Caddies or something. And, afterwards, I walked back into the shop, and the owner of the dealer group came over to me and said, "Hey, you know, thanks for doing that. I know you're new here and you don't really know the product that well, but it was nice to step into that." And I'm like, "Well, you know, she was struggling and she just gave us a pile of money, and I should be nice to her." She's like, "Well, that's the way it should be." And then he said to me, "You know, just remember, everyone's in sales." And a lot of people get offended at that advice. It's like, I'm an engineer, I'm not in sales. But the idea that we have ideas to sell, that we have product to sell, that if you're working for a company, what you do helps the company have income. If you're working for a nonprofit, the things that I do with Security B-Sides, I am selling idealism, I am selling ideals, I am selling community. That idea that what we do helps promote something greater was one of those things. And if you do that, I mean, my career honestly is not built on anything I've done other than help build communities, share what I've learned, you know, learn from other people and then share it back out. And that idea that, you know, we're here to move the idea forward. And whether that's a transactional sales or a sale of an idea, I think that was very important. There are a couple other car dealer ones just very quickly because I can't be that straight and idealistic. Mm-hmm. One of the first ones I realized is, and you can adjust this for whatever car you buy at whatever point in time, but you know, let's just pick something. We won't even put a brand name on it. You know, when you pay $80,000 for a car, I have a secret for you. They're not giving you the floor mats for free. This is life advice. and then something extremely cynical, which I don't take to heart, but it was sums up the auto industry and why I'm glad I'm no longer in it, which was that At one point in time, one of the factory guys came into us and was explaining a bunch of new changes with the dealerships and the manufacturers, and said to us, now just remember that sincerity is the key to success in business, because once you can fake that, you have it made.
That you cannot get more cynical than that.
That is the car business in a nutshell.
All right. Well, Jack, where can people find more about you, more about what you're working on, and more about Security B-Sides?
SecurityBsides.org. That's the word security, B-S-I-D-E-S, no dashes, not B-E-S-I-D, but B-S-I-D-E-S.org, is the global wiki. It's ugly, but it's an amazing place because there's information on the 385 events that have happened thus far. Dozens of them that are coming up. There's a map and calendar there. That's a great place to figure out what's going on with B-Sides. For me, on Twitter, Jack_Daniel, and that kind of leads in different places. I don't blog much anymore. I have a couple of neglected blogs, but the Jack_Daniel at Twitter, and that'll lead you to some of my other stuff occasionally, like the Shoulders of InfoSec wiki, which is just wiki.shouldersofinfosec.org. But that also leads to like my InfoSec Noir, which is a Twitter serial drama fiction of a cyber private eye, and other things like that, occasional rants about life and things. Don't expect a lot of technical content from me these days. I have opinions. I'm old. I'm the world's oldest millennial, and I get cranky at times, and then I get really idealistic and hug people.
Well, that's never a bad thing. And for people that haven't been to Jack's Twitter page, looks great in a red robe, I'm just going to say. So do yourself a favor, check that out. Jack Daniel, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. This was awesome.
This is great fun. Thank you very much.